Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, the logic of cooking is really amazing, and most cookbooks cheat us out of it. For example, we constantly eat very different seeming dishes that are really the same technique, except for their ingredients. Okay, that sounds insane, but look, here's what I mean. Today, a Mexican chef explains how the famous pumpkin seed sauces of Mexico are only one technique that becomes many different recipes. So maybe we should stop collecting recipes and instead collect techniques. Well, there's a lot more of this kind of thing coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Here's a basic for your culinary arsenal. If you change the shape of an ingredient, you'll change what happens in your mouth. I mean, it suddenly is crunchy or it's slippery, and the taste changes. Think steak and hamburger. Say meat, but not. Then look at Chinese food. I mean, this is genius at work, toying with our taste perceptions. They precision cut to play up texture, like stir-fried pork with water chestnuts. And then there's the Mexican brilliance of grinding seeds and nuts. You've got a flock of classic sauces that all begin with that technique. Well, Mexican chef Roberto Santibanez has done a book around this idea of one basic technique with many variations. It's called Truly Mexican. Roberto, welcome.
Thank you.
Roberto, tell me about these ground sauces in Mexico. They're called pipiens, right?
Yes, pipianes in plural, pipian in singular.
And what are they exactly?
Sauces or... And sometimes not necessarily a sauce, but a dip that is based generally on a seed or a seed mixture. You can find pipianes made of only pumpkin seeds. Pepitas, just green pumpkin seeds.
Right.
Or made of pumpkin seed with a little bit of sesame seed and a little bit of peanuts. Or you can find pipianes made only with unhulled pumpkin seeds. It all depends from where you come from who taught you, and from which region you're in. The pipianes vary enormously.
And then what else is in it, usually?
Sometimes there's a little bit of garlic, onions, and herbs. Sometimes it will be just garlic with a little bit of cumin and oregano.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes the pumpkin seeds are mixed with chiles guajillos to create a red pipián. Or sometimes sesame seeds are blended with chili seeds to produce with chiles anchos another complete different variation of the red pipián. Sometimes unhulled pumpkin seeds are put in the blender with hoja santa. And
that's that leaf that has almost an anisey taste to it.
Right, that big leaf. And that's it. You know, they blend it up, they cook it, and they serve it with pork. In the Central Plains, they will make a green pipián in Mexico City with just the whole pumpkin seed, the green pepita. Put a little bit of cilantro, a dash of cumin, and blend it up, cook it, and that's a pipián.
Huh. So is there a basic technique?
Yeah, I think there's a couple. Well, first, as you're using whatever seed you're using, that seed more often than not needs to be cooked to start the process of making something digestible. So either if it's hulled or unhulled, whatever seed this is needs to be toasted.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are always blend it into a sort of coarse, fine texture puree.
And is there liquid that you use to do this?
Yes. For example, you want to serve pipián with chicken. Well, you will poach your chicken and use that stock to blend. If it's pork, you would do the same. Or if you want to keep it on the vegetarian side, you will just use basically water and more chilies and more garlic to produce more of a full flavor experience.
So then do seasonings go into that puree or are the seasonings added afterward?
The seasonings here are a little bit of garlic, a big amount of chilies, whichever these ones you're using to make it red or green, and a little bit of spices, which sometimes are not even used. Like I said, just a touch of cumin, a touch of oregano in some. In some you would find one clove, you know, for a big batch, just to give a spirit to things. And the seasonings are blended together.
So you would then, once it's been blended, you would simmer it for a little bit of to blend the flavors, and then you're done?
Yeah, it does need to cook. It does need to cook to develop all the flavors and to make all the flavors combine and come together into a fine marriage. By the way, these sauces also can have this raw flavor if they're not cooked correctly.
Ah, so the idea is you really want to simmer them and you want to keep them in a sauce consistency. Not too
always,
thick.
Always. Okay. And you boil them up, and then that's where the cooks come in, and recipes are only a guideline. So you put your sauce to simmer, and 25 minutes later, you come, check it, stir it, and see if it's getting too thick. You add a little bit more water or stock.
Mm-hmm. The flavor sounds like it would be a very pure flavor of the taste of those toasty seeds. With the accent of the chilies, there's something about it that sounds like it's kind of deep and kind of lusty.
I love pipianes because of that. It's, you know, generally a seed contains a lot of protein or fat. So that mixed with the chilies and just a little bit of something else, it's always a very pleasing sauce because it's that silkiness from the oils of the nuts. Mm-hmm. And then that helps carry all these other flavors from the chilies and from the very little spices that you've used and makes a fantastic sauce.
It sounds like you could use it on anything.
Yes.
Hey, thank you, Roberto.
Thank you.
Chef Roberto Santibanez has restaurant Fonda in Brooklyn, New York, and he has a taco truck across the bay in Hoboken. His book is truly Mexican, and his simple pumpkin seed sauce, which is the most seductive shade of green, I've got to tell you, is on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our new series of podcasts, The Key Three, conversations with star cooks about the three recipes they feel every cook should know. And take a look at our newest work, A Summertime Grilling Guide. We've pulled together a bunch of grilling recipes to make your life at the grill a little easier. All the details are there, splendidtable.org. You know, there's something to be said for being the one who goes where few eaters have gone before. But take it from a woman who trekked half America looking for the great chicken fried steak. The heartburn just isn't worth it. Leave this sort of thing to the pros, like Jane and Michael Stern of roadfood.com. They have uncanny instincts. Hey, Jane, Michael, good to have you back with us.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So where have you been?
We were in Dallas, Texas. You know, it occurred to us while we were there that ambiance is really important in finding a great road food restaurant. And I am talking here about the ambiance of a place we found there called Fuel City.
That sounds very attractive. Well,
say, this is our kind of ambiance, which means there are longhorn cattle grazing out back. You dine at a picnic table. You get beer by the can or bottle inside from the largest selection of beer in the entire city of Dallas. And all the food is served at a takeout window. Nothing costs more than $2.
Oh, this does sound great. And I like that ambience, the $2 ambience especially.
Exactly.
Are we kind of stretching things by calling it gas station dining?
I think
why is it Fuel City?
Well, they have the largest and best car wash in all of Dallas,
as well as
I don't know, umpteen fuel pumps as well. So it is Fuel City.
So it's like the old thing, eat here, get gas?
Yes, exactly. Okay. But aside from the ambiance, you know, you can't eat ambiance, but what you can eat at Fuel City are some terrific, authentic Mexican-made tacos. I mean, you know, with picadillo in them, with barbacoa, with some more exotic parts of pigs and cows if you want them. And, you know, they're small, like maybe four or six of them might be a meal. You know, they're served with cilantro, hot sauce, a wedge of lime.
Ooh.
You know, they're simple, elegant, and just exactly, they're like street food, really.
And not a tourist in view.
This
is definitely the locals.
And there's nothing else on the menu except for all the gas station, you know, convenience food inside, except out in front of the stand, there is always a corn cart selling cups of warm corn. These are corn kernels that get mixed with cheese, sour cream, and hot sauce, a perfect companion for tacos.
Oh, you know what that sounds like?
Sounds like heaven to me.
Yeah, it is heaven. But Mexican market in our neck of the woods does these roasted corn on the cob in the summer. But then it's dipped in the sour, you know, the crema of Mexico.
Yep.
Exactly.
And then with the chili on the outside.
Yeah.
But it sounds like that same thing, except the cob has been eliminated.
It's the same idea.
It sounds fabulous.
It's more sort of fork worthy. I mean, you can slurp it up or eat it with a fork. Most people here dine off their dashboard or take these things to go, or there are actually a handful of picnic tables.
Right.
And when you dine at the picnic tables, you get a beautiful view of this herd of real old-fashioned longhorn Texas cows that graze out and back. I don't know what they're there for, maybe just for decor.
For the tacos.
But it's just great to be dining in Dallas, Texas with the cows in front of you. And then if you turn around, there is the skyline of the city of Dallas behind you. So it's kind of surreal, but really wonderful.
Sounds fabulous. Guys, thank you.
Thank you, Len.
Bye-bye,
Len.
Well, I like living on this highway. For many years it's been the way I've known. But no matter where I've been, no matter where I roam, I'm a shooting star from Texas, but the interstate's my home.
The Stearns have updated the book that started all this wandering years ago and gave us Sleeves Up Dining. It's the latest edition of Road Food. Now, for their finds of the moment, check out splendidtable.org. We're going to be back with a new round of Celebrity Stump the Cook and a prose pick of the best blogs. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things that are really in their refrigerator. I have to come up with a dish with those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. And the final judgment comes from our celebrity guest, Stump Master. Now, this week, it is the playwright and actor who moonlights on weekends at NPR. He's Peter Sagal. He's host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Hey, Peter, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Lynn. I'm thrilled.
Okay, are you ready for this?
Am I ready for this?
Yeah.
I've been ready my whole life. I've been waiting for someone to actually treat me as an authority on food.
Okay. Now,
and I don't know why it's taken so long, so let's get going.
All right. Now, just remember one thing. First of all, you were born in New Jersey, and I was born in New Jersey, so we have a bond, right? And we stick together.
Yes, and my job is to judge your results harshly.
Oh,
is this
please.
What I'm getting? Oh, yes.
Okay. Now, we have got a player waiting in the wings. He's from Scranton, Pennsylvania. Tim, are you there? Welcome.
Yes, I am. Hi, Lynn. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Tim.
Okay. All right. Now, Tim, you know how we play the game, right?
Yes.
Okay. So five things that are really in your refrigerator at this very moment.
Okay. Maple syrup.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Beef kielbasa. And these are regional items.
Quit now, Lynn.
Yeah, this is good.
Oh, it gets better.
All right. Okay. Okay.
A local porter beer, dark beer.
Okay. Porter, dark beer. All right. Okay. It's still okay. Yeah.
Fresh coconut.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
That one's not local.
Yeah.
And neither is this one. This is something from, I lived in New Orleans for a couple of years, and we can get it at a local produce shop here called Alligator Pears or Merlotons.
Alligator pears.
Yeah. They're a very mild, almost like a summer squash. They're about the size of your fist, and they're usually either steamed or stuffed and roasted.
Okay. All right. Let's see.
So I just want to say, by the way, beef, maple syrup, coconut, and alligator pears was my family's Seder growing up, so this is all very familiar to me.
Now, just so that everybody understands that I'm not working solely with five ingredients, I do, with our game, get salt, pepper, water, a choice of fat, and three ingredients that, Tim, that you really have on hand, okay?
Okay.
you're going to slice the kielbasa, okay, into long strips. It's almost going to look like really thick bacon, okay? And you're going to marinate it in the beer and the maple syrup. And then you're going to take some bacon fat. This blows the Seder, Peter. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
You know, we were non-traditional anyway with the coconut and the kielbasa, so I think that really is not going to hurt. Go on.
You're going to take some bacon fat, and you're going to slice up the alligator pears, pan fry them, okay, so that they're really crisp, you know, do them real fast, lay them out on a plate, and then what you're going to do in that same pan, you're going to lightly toast the coconut and put that aside, all right? And then you'll take the kielbasa, you'll lift it out of the marinade, pat it dry, and brown it on both sides, because kielbasa is usually already cooked anyway. And you're going to lay that crisscross over the alligator pear, and you're going to sprinkle the toasted coconut on it. And it's going to be called the Scranton fry.
The Scranton fry. Okay.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Hold on. Can I ask a question? When you say you lay out the long, browned, marinated, sweetened bits of kielbasa, does it spell anything like SOS?
No, but you could play you could play tic-tac-toe.
Yes, I see. So you're making sort of like a, so it's an attractive pattern.
You've got it, yeah, because, you know, chefs today are setting up these plates that have height. Well, you'll pile the coconut and you'll get, you know, sort of that mountainous sort of look. Look, this is a hopeless case. Help me.
I was about to say, this is a desperation three-pointer in the buzzer. I have to applaud.
So, Tim, honest, you don't have to be too honest.
Oh, I can be completely honest.
Yeah, would you ever make this?
I don't think I would make anything with maple syrup.
I have been sabotaged. I mean, before we even started, I was sabotaged.
Now, let me say that I will try anything once. I'm a foodie, and I love to eat. In fact, we plan our vacations around where we're going to eat.
Okay, okay.
So I would definitely try it.
All right, but now the final judgment belongs to
Peter.
Well,
I have to say, I mean, I'm torn here. Because on the one hand, if somebody came up to me with those ingredients, as Tim just described,
right,
my only reaction would be to slowly back out of the room. I mean, I think that you need points just for, like, rising to this challenge. But sliced kielbasa marinated in maple syrup. And what else did you marinate it with? You marinated
beer.
It with the... Well, the beer's good. And coconut? It sounds...
This is where I think I'd better quit while I'm ahead and admit I've lost, haven't
I? I think clearly you left out the sixth ingredient, which is, of course, reservations. I think I would not eat that without a gun to my head. You lose.
All right.
But
okay.
It was a noble effort.
Now I have a question.
Sure, Tim.
It appears that I've won. Do I get Carl Castle's voice on my home answering machine?
Only if you make him that dish.
I'll
do
that.
Hey, Tim, thanks for playing Stump the Cook.
Well, thank you very much.
And Peter, thank you, sir, for playing Stump the Cook. And tell Carl I say hello.
I will send everybody your best and advise them to eat elsewhere.
Peter Sagal hosts NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You too can play Stump the Cook. Get to us with your five ingredients, and if the stars align properly, one of our cunning producers may call you to play on the air. Well, you know, I can't leave Tim with that bomb of a recipe. I really can't. There's a recipe on the website. It's by John Martin Taylor. It's a specialty of the St. Helena's Island on the South Carolina coast. It's called Frogmore Stew. Now, you can use your kielbasa actually in the stew, drink the beer with the stew, and drizzle that blessed maple syrup over hot cornbread. It's all on the website, splendidtable.org. Cookbook author Sally Schneider is co-creator of the Improvised Life website. Now, Sally's one of our regulars. Over the years, she and I have covered a lot of cooking territory. But today I want to head into another realm. Hey, Sally, welcome.
Good to be here, Lynn.
So when you're looking at blogs, what's an outstanding blog for you?
Well, first, Lynn, I need to say that I look at 60 to 70 blogs every morning.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is, you know, a hard thing to hone down. But I'll give you some of my favorites. One of them is called Kotke, written by Jason Kotke. And it's really a miscellany of interesting things that have to do with innovative thinking. I find all kinds of stuff, from artists to science to even food. Here's an example. He recently did a post that was talking about a review of this massive new cookbook about molecular gastronomy called Modern Cuisine, and how the discoveries in molecular gastronomy have allowed chefs to serve customers things they never thought possible, like edible clay and rocks and foods that change temperature and stuff like that. And then simultaneously, he posted an excerpt from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is a children's book by Roald Dahl, which includes marshmallow pillows, lickable wallpaper for nurseries, and hot ice cream for cold days. And the juxtaposition was perfect. It made me want to go look at this book about molecular gastronomy, and it started me thinking a little differently about it. So there's one example.
Right. So it's not always the food blog.
It's definitely not the food blog, because I want things that open my head up generally to solving problems and being creative. That goes from recipes to my table settings to how I organize my space to how I live my life, how I do my work.
So some other blogs that you like.
There's a really fantastic design blog called Remodelista, which is great if you want sources and ideas for, say, kitchen design or home design and products. Something I got there today, which I'll give you an example. There was a trivet that cost $120 that's made of brass, high design. And I look at it and I say, that looks like some kind of old machine part. Well, I'm going to go look for old machine parts that'll cost 10 bucks and see if I can fashion a trivet. They also have something called Remodelista's Design Newsstand, which is their 100 favorite blogs. And you can just go there and see little thumbnails of what's up on each blog, including mine. And it's changing constantly. So that's a really great resource.
You know, what I'm hearing from you is you're not particularly excited about the diary blogs, you know, the ones of this morning I had oatmeal for breakfast.
I actually can't think of one that I read. I really don't like them because they don't provide me with content that interests me. I would rather have a wee blog or a blog that's about the world that I can apply to my own life, except for one blog that is an I blog, called Peace and Love and Noticing the Details, which is written by a mysterious woman named Anne Herbert. And she writes these Zen-like things that are so amazing that instantly open my head up. Some of them she's found on the street. Here's an example. It's a super-duper long shot, but I got nothing else to do, so why not? What I love about it is it asks why not, which is the key to any creative thinking, including improvising recipes or anything else.
Are there recipe blogs, you know, food-focused blogs that really draw you?
There are a few. My favorite, I would say, is Hank Shaw's Hunter Gatherer Gardener Cook, because he's out there in the field. He's hunting, he's gathering, he's trying stuff. That is an iBlog, but it's about his process of trying to figure things out with wild foods and raw materials. So I check in there. Home design blogs, say, for example, the blog Swiss Miss, there was a fantastic asymmetrical stove hood that looked like a sculpture. And it made me think, why can't I design a stove hood that isn't the usual upright thing, that goes up, veers off to the left, and is really something to look at? It changed my thinking, which is what I want.
I get the gist. Hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook. Try her simple, simple recipe for peas. It's sugar snaps with extra virgin olive oil and shaved Parmigiano. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Lines are open. We're taking your calls. That's 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or email us, splendidtable.org. We've got Jim calling from Memphis. Jim, hi. Is there something on your mind, sir?
Good morning.
Good morning. I am very good.
Great. Let me tell you, my wife and I love to cook and love to eat. We love to listen to you on Sunday morning down here on public radio.
Music to my ears.
And when we go into a grocery store, we start looking at fruits and vegetables and just, you know, we go from one to another. And we can stand around and talk for 30 minutes about the joys of let's buy some of this and we'll do this with it and do that with it. And to be specific, we bought a big container of cherry tomatoes.
Right.
And so we get it home, and we'll pop them in our mouths, and we'll slice them and put them on eggs.
Right.
And then they go into the refrigerator, and the box kind of drifts to the back of the shelf.
Right.
4 or 5 days later, you know, here's this box of half-shriveled, wonderful little tomatoes. What do we do with things that are like half the size they used to be?
All right. First of all, one thing. Tomatoes, don't put the tomatoes in the fridge because it kills their taste.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. But they do get shriveled. Now, there's a difference between shrivel and rot. Okay. But when they're merely shriveled, what's happened is those little puppies are starting to dry up. And if they're starting to dry up, their flavor is concentrating. And I did a book on eating in the Italian countryside, you know, the way the rural people eat, farm people. And there's a thing that they do in Puglia, with the heel of the Italian boot, where at the end of the season when the tomatoes are not quite ripe, and they have these small oval tomatoes, not unlike grape tomatoes, they're intensely flavored. They will take them right on the branch. And they'll put them in the cellar in any place where it's dark and it's very airy. And they'll hang them so the tomatoes aren't necessarily touching each other, so you don't have a chance of rot. And they start to shrivel. And what you end up, they don't really dry completely, but you get this really concentrated tomato. And there are dishes that they do during cold weather that are utterly amazing. And they just sort of squish them in the pan. And this is what you can do with your tomatoes. You film a big skillet with a bit of olive oil, okay? You can gently in that pan saute some onion or brown it fast, however you want.
Mm-hmm.
But just get it to start to color. And then take those shriveled tomatoes and you plop them in that pan and you press them down with the back of a spatula so that they fry. That oil, and they get caramelized, and they get, I can't explain it, they actually get sugary, and they get a tinge of bitterness from the browning, and then they get this deliciousness that you never would taste if it hadn't been cooked. And then you just toss that with pasta. Or you put it on bread, or you pour it in a bowl and you dunk things in it.
Okay.
Or when the oil cools, you just drink it. I mean, it's delicious. It's
great,
really, really fabulous. So just make sure they're not rotting. And in fact, if you think you're going to hold them, spread them out on a basket on a counter.
Okay.
So that
okay.
they're really, you know, they'll dry a bit.
Can you do that with others? Anything else?
Well, you know, I've done it. I've noticed one thing. Like when you get into fruit season and you get into stone fruits, which you guys are going to be in 45 minutes down in
yes.
Memphis, right?
Yep.
But when you let peaches or nectarines sit on the counter, again, not getting bad, not getting the mold or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get them, they start to actually almost shrivel a bit.
Yeah.
Their sugars are incredibly concentrated.
Oh, wonderful.
And they are delicious. You slice those babies and you put them on a grill.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Great. This is super.
Enjoy.
Great. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, trust me on this. You can talk to us. All you have to do is call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Amy calling from North Bennington, Vermont. Amy, you are in one of the most beautiful places I've ever visited.
Oh, it is beautiful here.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, I have to say. So what do you want to talk about?
Well, as you probably know, it's ramp season here.
Oh, yeah. It's ramp season in a lot of places.
It is. And so near our house, we found the mother load of ramps. And so we go tromping in the woods and we pick them.
Right.
And I use them. I roast salmon with them. I make a version of vichyssoise with them.
Oh,
but
God,
what I would like to
good.
Do is to pickle them for martinis or gimlets.
Oh, I think that's a great idea.
Or rampinis, as we like to call them.
Yes, I like that. Rampinis, that's really good. What's a great idea?
So I need some advice on how to pickle the ramps.
Well, I think it's really basic. Get them really clean. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cut them in whatever size you want them to be. Okay. Take some white wine vinegar. And you want to do salt.
Mm-hmm.
And then all you have to do is boil that combination just for a few moments, just to kind of sterilize it. Stuff the ramps into a sterilized jar. Pour that over it. Let it cool. Stick it in the fridge.
That's it?
That's it. That's it. You don't have to do a thing more, and you're there.
That sounds wonderful. Do you, I think we would trim the leaves.
Yeah, no, take the leaves off, because whenever green gets in contact with acid, what happens is the green turns army green. It's revolting. You want the white part of the ramps.
We want people to drink these rampinis.
Exactly, exactly. And just one other thing. I hear that in some parts of the country, ramps are actually being threatened, that they've become so popular.
Really?
Yeah. So when you go out to pick that mother load, leave, you would probably do this anyway, but just leave some there for next year.
There are so many there. I mean,
great.
You
don't have a problem.
Not at all.
Because, you know, they've gotten a lot of press over the past couple of years, and people are wiping them out.
Yeah. No, there's thousands and thousands where we go, and, you know, people leave it alone.
That's great. Hey, enjoy the rampinis.
We will. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I never thought about it. Of course, we pickle onions for martinis and a lot of other things. You know, there's another thing you can do with that pickle. If you don't want to use it in a drink or you want it to be sweet, it's one part sugar, two parts vinegar, and one part water. Or just one part sugar and two parts vinegar, and you get this little bit of sweetness. And then you throw in a little chili, a little clove, and some bay leaf, and a cinnamon stick. And you warm that. Let it cool, and then you pour that over whatever you want to pickle, and you stick it in the fridge. You've got to keep it refrigerated because it's really not enough to preserve it for a long time. Anyway, it is time for this week's Trivia Challenge. Now, the question is, what's a new way to buy a pal a drink? Well, we will return with that answer, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's a new way to buy a pal a drink? Well, you can text a pal a Pepsi. Pepsi has a new social vending machine. You give the machine information and it sends a code to a faraway friend. He uses the code to get a free soda. But wait, there's more. The machine lets you make videos and perform what Pepsi calls random acts of refreshment. That is, send free drinks to strangers. Spread those sugar highs, guys. Okay, back to you. Let's see who is up. We've got Erin calling from British Columbia. Erin, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have an embarrassing confession to make. I am incapable of making rice pudding. And the reason that this is embarrassing, I think, this is a shameful confession, is that it seems to me that rice pudding is one of those things everyone can make. You know, it's you get it in Greek restaurants, you get it in Indian restaurants, you get it at crummy diners, and I love it. And every time I've tried to make it, I've had a bit of a disaster.
So what goes wrong usually?
Well, I admit that I don't think I've ever returned to the same recipe twice because they've all sort of gone awry. So I have tried the kind of recipe where you cook the rice in milk.
Yeah.
Or milk and a combination of half and half. And
right.
What I've gotten is something sort of dry, very puffy rice kernels.
Oh.
I've also tried leftover rice.
Right.
You then cook in milk and sugar, and I've gotten sort of rice floating in
milk and sugar. Yeah,
yes,
okay.
Which has not been very pudding-like.
Right.
And I've also tried a recipe that I've seen in a number of English cookbooks where you put uncooked rice in half and half or milk, and you put it in the oven at a low temperature.
And you let it bake. You seal it.
Bake for a very, very long time. And what I've wound up with is little crunchy bits that stick between your teeth.
Something is very strange here. What kind of rice are you using?
I usually just use plain old boring white from the bulk section of the supermarket.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, a couple of things come to mind. First of all, I think you want to cook the rice in the milk because that's where you're going to get the thickening. And the real pudding-like consistency. And what you might want to do... Go ahead.
I was going to say, it does occur to me that while I'm usually adding some half and half, often a lot of the liquid that I'm using is non-fat milk. Do you think that's part of the problem?
I'm not sure if it is, but why not go for whole milk just for the heck of it?
And I suspect that part of what's happened is that I've gotten spooked.
Yeah, well, you probably have, and you're second-guessing yourself.
Right. I know how to make pie crusts, and people are afraid of pie crusts. So why am I afraid of rice pudding?
I know the syndrome all too well.
Yes, and so I feel that the rice can smell my fear.
Okay, this is the thing you're going to do. First of all, in that bulk section, there may be something called medium grain or short grain rice.
Oh.
Now, that tends to have a different kind of starch than the long grain rice. And that starch tends to have a gelatinous quality. It's what you would use in risotto. You know how creamy risotto can be?
Yeah.
So this will give you sort of a leg up in getting that creamy rice pudding kind of thing. Then take a really good recipe. And that recipe might come from online at Bon Appetit, okay, because they test their recipes like crazy. The Old Gourmet site tests their recipes like crazy. Better Homes and Gardens, Ladies Home Journal. These are all outfits that really test their recipes. They will not let you down, you know, because every recipe out there doesn't necessarily work. Generally speaking, for rice pudding, you want a cup of rice, 2.5 cups or so of milk. And I would skip the half and half for a moment. Just go with straight whole milk. Right. Whatever amount of sugar is called for and other flavorings. Okay. Yeah. Nothing acidic, so don't add orange juice or anything like that.
No acid.
And then what you're going to do is you're going to take that rice and you're going to bring that liquid to a very, very, very low simmer, add the rice, cover it, and cook it over extremely low heat. The alternative to this is to drop the rice in boiling water, you know, that's like pasta, you know, a lot of boiling water, cook it for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, drain it, then mix it with the liquid, put it in a sealed container and put it in a low oven.
Oh.
That parboil just gives it a boost. And the other trick, if you want a third option, soak the rice first in water for a couple of hours.
Soak rice.
and then just cook it in the liquid as you normally would.
I feel soothed. I feel much better. I suspect this might work.
I think that's going to do the trick.
Lynn, thank you so very much.
You are very welcome. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
Bye, Erin. Bye. Call us 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Emma wrote us from Falls Church, Virginia, and she wants to know, what do bay leaves do? Well, Emma, bay leaves are aromatic. They kind of taste like a combination of black pepper and cloves and orange, if you have an imagination. And essentially, they gently add those flavors to whatever you put them in. Now, frankly, I personally wonder if we really need them, because unless they're fresh, and they're going to show up in, you know, during summer usually, unless they're fresh, bay leaves do not bring a lot to the party unless they're really, really prime. And that means expensive. And I like to buy my herbs in a place where I can actually sniff them first. Some spice shops have that kind of thing where there's a jar and you can just sniff, because you should get that aroma of the clove and the orange and the black pepper and an herbal kind of aroma. If you get that, then it's going to add flavor. If you don't bother. We have got Madeline calling from Concord, New Hampshire. Madeline, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm so glad I get to talk to you. I need help conquering my culinary nemesis, which is the angel food cake. My beloved boyfriend. This is the cake that he's traditionally had for his birthday.
Ah.
Angel food cake with strawberries and whipped cream. And I'm a fairly competent baker. I really enjoy baking, and I like a good challenge, so I figured I would try to make an angel food cake. But I've tried several times now, and every time it comes out as a goopy, deflated mess.
Are you using the special angel cake form? You know, it's a round cake pan that's very deep. It has a funnel in the middle, because an angel food cake usually has a hole in the middle. And it has extensions on the top of it, that because you want to cool an angel food cake upside down.
Yes, I've been doing that. I have a two-part tube mold that has the little feet that project out from the edges.
Right, so you actually cool this baby upside down, which I've always thought is the most absurd thing you can imagine doing with a cake. Okay.
I know.
All right. Let's go through this step by step here. All right. First of all, which recipe are you using?
So I'm using Alton Brown's recipe.
All right. Alton is solid, but there are two other people you might want to check. Okay?
Okay.
Number one, Shirley Currier. She did a book called Bakewise.
Okay.
She is a food scientist. In fact, Alton used to have her on his show a lot. She's a brilliant, brilliant cook and a food scientist. Shirley's recipe will work come hell or high water. The other person that will be absolutely reliable will be Rose Levy Barenbaum. She did a book called The Cake Bible, and she's got a more recent book out on cakes. Cake Bible came out in the 80s. It's still in print.
Okay,
so that's number one. Number two, how are you beating your egg whites? What kind of bowl are you using?
I've been doing them in my stand mixer, so I have the metal bowl.
Good, and is it completely clean?
Yeah, I've been very careful. I know that fat will completely ruin the egg whites.
Okay,
so
yeah, that's where I was
cleaning
gonna
everything before.
Right.
What about
your oven? Do you have an oven thermometer in your oven?
I do. I'm a big fan of your show, so I picked up that trick from you.
All right, you're making this even harder. I was really hoping we had an easy fix here, but we don't.
But I do think it might have something to do with the cooking, because looking at different recipes, I've found a range of different oven temperatures and a pretty large range of cooking times.
You know, that's true, and that's why I think I would really get my hands on Bakewise or the Cake Bible. And look online. You may find one of their recipes online. And
okay.
I would look up their angel food cake recipes, because both of those women really know what they're doing.
Okay. Some of the recipes say to put the cake in the lower third of the oven, and some say to put it completely as low as possible.
I think that although that's important, more important is the actual temperature and time.
Okay.
And often in some ovens, that pan is so tall, you kind of have to have it in the lower third.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really depends on the oven. But I would check out Rose Levy Barenbaum or Shirley Currier.
All right.
And they will give you, if they do a cake recipe, it's going to work.
All right.
Okay. And happy birthday to your boyfriend.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Why don't you connect with us on Facebook? You could follow us on Twitter. You can call us, 800-537-5252, or you can even send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. I found a cookbook that's a bit of a turnaround. Now, a lot of cookbooks tell us how not to eat something harmful, you know, the fat, the sugar, and all of that. Well, this is a small cookbook published in Florida, and it's selling the idea of eating something that is harmful. Well, not to we humans, but to the sea. The book is The Lionfish Cookbook, The Caribbean's New Delicacy. Ladd Akins is the co-author, and he's also the founding executive director of the Reef Environmental Education Foundation. And Ladd's on the phone. Ladd, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn.
So what's the story behind this?
Well, you're right in that you pointed out this is not harmful to us. There's no danger in eating this fish, but there's a danger in leaving it out there and not eating it, actually. A lionfish or invasive species are not native to the Caribbean or Atlantic Ocean, and they become invasive here as a non-native fish and are causing a lot of problems.
What kind of problems?
Well, they're a carnivore, and they tend to eat anything that fits into their mouth, which is quite large. And through their consumption and predation on our native marine life, we're very concerned about the health of our marine ecosystems.
To what degree are we talking here? Is this local in the Florida area? Is it the Caribbean? Where?
Well, Lynn, it actually started in Florida, most likely through aquarium pets being released. Lionfish are very popular in the aquarium trade.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're talking a range from North Carolina to South America, from the Eastern Caribbean all the way over to Central America and the Gulf of Mexico, an incredible range.
Well, how big are they?
Well, they can get pretty good size, almost half a meter, even though they're popular when they're small in the aquariums.
That's like almost 20 inches.
Yeah, we're talking a good-sized fish.
Wow.
Much larger here, I should point out, than in the native range. They get about a foot or so in the native range.
And the native range is where? Where are they originally from?
Well, the huge area of the Indo-Pacific and Red Sea. So very broad areas that lionfish are found naturally. But the issue is they're not found in such high numbers as we have here. There are controlling mechanisms in that native range that prevent them from taking over. And whatever those are, we don't have them here. And the impacts they're having are very widespread. They consume commercially important species, grouper and snapper. They consume the juveniles of those fish. They compete with those fish for resources and food. And they also consume ecologically important species, like parrotfish that graze on algae which compete with corals, like cleaner species that pick parasites off other fish, and clean wounds to maintain the health of the system.
So why aren't they being eaten by bigger fish so that that would be the control?
Well, that's a good question, and we don't know the absolute answer to that, but we have some good guesses. And one of those is that lionfish have venomous spines only. It's not the meat of the fish.
Right.
But very prominent defenses which would deter a predator. So even though they may appear like they could be a potential food source for our large predators like sharks or groupers, with that defense, it's not likely we're going to see a lot of predation.
So essentially, one of the solutions you see is we should be eating lionfish.
Well, it's their only weakness. Here you have this almost perfect invader.
Right.
And the only weakness is that they taste great. Very lightly flavored, delicate. It's a great eating fish. And hopefully that will be their demise.
But are we going to be seeing lionfish in fish stores? Or is it something that if we are divers, you know, we'll catch them?
Well, certainly we're encouraging local consumption. When people see lionfish, if they're diving, you know, spear the lionfish instead of the grouper or snapper. And certainly it's a better eating fish than grouper or snapper, so it warrants that attention. But there are also a number of restaurants now throughout the Caribbean that are serving lionfish on the menus, and there's quite a demand at high-end boutique restaurants here in the U.S. for lionfish as well. I don't know to what extent we'll see it in the fish market, but I bet there'll be some specialty wholesalers that will carry lionfish.
You know, I have to give you a lot of credit. This is sort of an unusual way to control predators. Ladd, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Ladd Akins is co-author of The Lionfish Cookbook, The Caribbean's New Delicacy. And on the website, we've got a recipe for a spicy lionfish with dill sauce. That's splendidtable.org. And that's the show for this week. Hey, thanks for being with us. And I hope you have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Anonymous. Fish should smell like the ocean. If they smell like fish, it's too late. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Check out our new series of podcasts, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. And take a look at our newest project, a summertime grilling guide, 40 recipes to get you cooking outside this summer. All that information is, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Peters. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.